Hi, I want to talk to you today about Kurt Gödel's argument for the existence of God. It was found among his unpublished papers. He gave a couple of pages to Dana Scott, in which he proved sometime in the 1940s that God exists on the basis of a few fairly simple axioms. We're going to talk today not about his original axioms, but about the slight revision of those axioms proposed by C. Anthony Anderson, which solves a problem, both an intuitive problem and a technical problem, in the original presentation. Gödel himself was the greatest logician of the 20th century. He proved the completeness of first-order logic, the incompleteness of the language of arithmetic, and then he showed in his second incompleteness theorem that no theory can prove its own consistency. In addition to all of that, he managed to show the consistency and independence of the axiom of choice in set theory, and later he proved that there are models admitting time travel in Einstein's theory of general relativity. So, Gödel, an original member of the Vienna Circle, who spent most of his career, once the Nazis took over, at Princeton's Institute for Advanced Study, and was a close friend of Einstein there, managed to come up with fundamental results. Indeed, in many ways, you can teach the history of logic in the 20th century as really a history of Gödel's results. Well, what was this argument that Gödel proposed for God's existence? It was inspired by Anselm's ontological argument, with some embellishments due to Descartes, Leibniz, and of course Gödel himself. How does the argument go? Well, there are a few simple axioms, a few definitions, and then some theorems. So let's talk, first of all, about a concept that is used throughout the axioms that is really fundamental. It's the idea of a property being positive. Now, what is a positive property? Well, it's his version of something that Descartes would have called a perfection. Or in Anselm, in the Monologion, section 15, he talks about certain properties as being positive in the sense that it's better to have them than not to have them. Is it better to be powerful or weak? Is it better to be strong or weak? Is it better to be alive or dead? Is it better to exist or not to exist? And so on. And the ones it's better to have are the positive properties. Now, in Gödel's original proof, he assumes that every property or its negation is positive. And that forces us to say that either red or not red is positive, either square or not square is positive, and so on. I think the revision has an appeal partly because it avoids that assumption. We can say certain properties it's better to have than not to have, or to have their opposites, but other properties it's simply neutral. It doesn't matter whether something is colored red or not. It doesn't matter whether something is square or circular, and so on. And so we can say that certain things, like power, knowledge, wisdom, existence, are positive, better to have them than not to have them, and not commit ourselves on certain other properties. Well, that idea of a positive property is one that does get embellished in the axioms. So before we go any further, let's take a look at the axioms that Gödel proposes. The first axiom that Gödel proposes says this: if a property is positive, then its negation is not positive. So we never have a property and its negation being positive. At most, one of them can be. And in the Anderson revision, neither could be. It might turn out, for example, that neither red nor not red is a positive property. But existence, if existence is a positive property, better to have it than not to have it, then it turns out non-existence can't be a positive property. The same thing, if being powerful is a positive property, then being weak can't be a positive property. The second axiom says that any property entailed by a positive property is itself positive. In other words, any property that is a necessary condition for a positive property is itself positive. So if you have to have this property in order to have some other positive property, it too is a positive property. For example, let's say that you can't be powerful without existing. Well, then if powerful is a positive property, so is existence. Similarly, if being knowledgeable is a necessary condition for having wisdom, and having wisdom is a positive property, then being knowledgeable is a positive property too. This is going to have the consequence that all properties like being self-identical or having either P or not P, for example, will turn out to be positive properties. Everything has them, so of course they are necessary conditions on a thing being a thing and having any properties at all, as well as having any positive properties. So the third axiom says that being godlike is a positive property. Well, that makes sense. Better to be God than not to be God. It's good to be God. But let's think exactly about what it is to be godlike. Gödel gives us a definition of the term godlike. Something is godlike if and only if it has as essential properties all and only positive properties. Think back to Descartes, who says God is a perfect being. God has all perfections. That's something like the idea behind Gödel's definition. Something is like God if it has all and only positive properties. It has all the positive properties, it has all the perfections, and it has nothing else. It doesn't have any properties that are not positive. There is no imperfection, in other words, in God. So it has all perfections, none of the imperfections. That's the central idea here. God has all the positive properties, and has no properties that are not positive properties. The fourth axiom. If a property is positive, then it's a necessary truth that it's positive. In other words, being positive is not something that is merely a contingent property of a property. It is something that is necessary if it's there at all. So if, for example, being powerful is a positive property, then it is necessary that being powerful is a positive property. Really, what this amounts to is we're interested in what counts as positive in every possible world, not just as a contingent matter of fact in our world. It might be that in our world, for example, having an engineering degree is a positive thing. Better to have one than not to have one. But that's a contingent fact about our world. It's not true in all worlds. So we don't want to conclude from this that God has an engineering degree. Instead, we're going to say, look, we're interested in the perfections, those properties that are positive in all the worlds, not just happen to be positive in our world because of contingent matters of fact. So that's a way of saying, look, we are interested in the properties that God has. Those are going to be properties that it's good to have. And we mean really, absolutely, necessarily good to have, not simply happen to be good to have in this particular world. The fifth axiom says that necessary existence is a positive property. That's a way of saying, in other words, that, as Descartes put it, existence is a perfection. In fact, necessary existence is a perfection. Being able to be destroyed, being able not to exist, seems like an imperfection. It's something that makes you vulnerable. There's something negative about it. Would you rather be invulnerable or vulnerable? Would you rather be somebody who is going to be around no matter what, or would you rather be the sort of person who is mortal? Immortal or mortal? I choose immortal. Necessary existence seems like a really good thing to have. And so that counts as a positive property. The last axiom is one that it's easy to confuse with axiom 4. It also is about properties being positive and about necessity. But it goes slightly differently. It says that if something is a positive property, then the necessity of that property is also a positive property. So, for example, if being powerful is a positive property, then so is being necessarily powerful. If existing is a positive property, then so is necessarily existing. So, in short, if a property P is a positive property, then necessarily P is also a positive property. Well, those are the axioms. Now notice, they don't sound very controversial. In fact, they're pretty straightforward. Some of them are about the fact that counting as a positive property is not a contingent thing. And having a property necessarily seems positive if having that property is itself positive. So in short, those axioms are about saying that being positive is something that is meant to be independent of which particular world you're in. It's not something we're treating as a matter of contingent fact. It's a matter of the nature of the property itself. Really, the only two axioms that have much substantive content, that are about more than the modal status and the logic of positive properties, are the two that reflect premises in Descartes' version of the ontological argument, that God is a perfect being and has all perfections, or here, that being godlike is a positive property, and the other, that existence is a perfection, or in Gödel's terms, that necessary existence is a positive property. To make the content of those axioms clear, and also to make more precise some concepts we need in proving the theorems that Gödel goes on to prove, we need two more definitions. The first is the definition of an essence of a thing. It goes like this. Say that A is an essence of X if and only if it entails all and only X's necessary properties. That is to say, for every property B, X has B necessarily if and only if A entails B. Let's put that in more intuitive terms. The idea is that an essence is something that implies all and only something's necessary properties. Often people think of the essence of a thing as simply the collection of its necessary properties. Well, here an essence counts as something that implies all and only those necessary properties. So we could take it as some property that somehow combines all of those, but really the idea that's central here is not that it's simply a collection of properties, but instead it's some property that actually implies everything in that collection and nothing that's outside of that collection. So it encapsulates, if you want to think of it this way, all the necessary properties of the thing. The second definition is one of necessary existence. And here Gödel means something a little stronger than what we ordinarily mean by necessary existence. He says, X necessarily exists if and only if every essence of X is necessarily exemplified. So to be necessarily existent in these terms is for every essence to be necessarily exemplified. Well, if an essence simply encapsulates all the necessary properties, that's a way of saying that all of your necessary properties are necessarily exemplified. And I don't mean each one by one, I mean all together. The collection of your necessary properties is itself necessarily exemplified. In every possible world, there is something that has that collection of necessary properties. So it is a somewhat unusual conception of necessary existence, but it's going to entail the usual one, and so we don't need to worry about that. However, it is important that when we talk about this being a positive property, that's the concept he means, necessary existence in this sense. Now, you might object to the proof, in fact, because you don't like that axiom. You realize, wait, this is something stronger than what we'd ordinarily mean by existence or even necessary existence. Am I so sure that that's a positive property? So Rob Koons, for example, has attacked Gödel's argument on the basis of attacking that axiom, axiom 5, that says that necessary existence is a positive property. But for now, I want to pass over that and think about the theorems that Gödel derives from this. The first theorem reflects Gödel's main motivation for actually devising this proof in the first place. He thought that if there was an obvious flaw in the proofs of Anselm and of Descartes, they never really show you that the concept of God itself is consistent, that there could be a being such as God. They argue that if there could be, then the existence of God is necessary, but whatever the success of that argument, they never really convince you that the existence of God is even possible. Gödel had been studying Leibniz, who thought that was a fundamental flaw in Descartes' proof and also in Anselm's. Now, Anselm does have a sort of argument. He says even the fool, the person who says there is no God, shows that he understands what the claim is that there is or is not a God. And the only way that could actually be understood is if the person has the idea of God in their head. Well, that seems to show that, apart from questions of existence or non-existence, that God's existence is conceivable. The atheist conceives of it, but then rejects it. However that might be, Leibniz is concerned to say, yes, but that doesn't really convince me that this is a completely consistent conception, that there could be such a thing. For example, if someone says there is no such thing as a round square, I understand what's being said, but that doesn't mean that I can conceive of a round square or that a round square is actually possible. So Leibniz says, I want something more to convince me that this is something that is actually possible, that, in other words, the concept of God is consistent. He doesn't see Descartes really offering us anything in that respect. What if the perfections are in some way mutually inconsistent? Now, Leibniz proceeds to argue that, well, think about what the various perfections that go into our concept of God are. He says in the end they are primitive, indefinable things. And precisely because they're indefinable, because they are primitives, they can be combined. The only way, he says, we could actually uncover some kind of inconsistency is to look at the definitions of them and find that when we put them all together, there's some kind of incoherence or contradiction. But he says, look, if they're all primitive terms, that can't be. Gödel thinks it's not quite so easy to show that all of these things are actually primitive terms. In fact, he thinks that's the wrong way of going about it. Instead, his first theorem is meant to address Leibniz's problem, but to solve it in a different way. Here's what he says. If a property is positive, then it's consistent. If a property is positive, then it is consistent. That is to say, it's possible for it to be exemplified. There is no contradiction in it. Now, at first glance, you might say, that's pretty surprising. How did we get that out of our definitions and axioms? But actually, the proof is very simple. And as we'll see, the goal here is to argue that the concept of God, or in his terms, being godlike, is consistent. Why? Because one of the axioms says it's a positive property. But how do we get there? First, let's assume that something is a positive property. How do we get the conclusion that it's consistent, that it is possibly exemplified? Here's the proof. Say that property P is positive. Then not P is not positive by axiom one. P implies self-identity. Anything that has this property P must be identical to itself. So, as it turns out, that, too, being self-identical is a positive property.
That follows by axiom two. By axiom one, moreover, it follows that self-diversity, or self-difference, in other words, not being what you are, X not being equal to X, that's got to not be a positive property. But now notice that if you follow from a positive property, you must yourself be positive, and nothing is a positive property that also has a positive property as its negation. Why is that important? Well, because an inconsistent property is one that would imply every property. Okay, anything that is an inconsistency in classical logic implies everything. So in particular, it would imply not only self-identity, but self-diversity. It would imply not only X equals X, but X is not equal to X. However, a positive property can never imply a property that is not positive. So we get the conclusion that any positive property is consistent. If it were inconsistent, it would imply every property, including those that are not positive. Well, one of our axioms says that the property of being godlike is a positive property. So the property of being godlike is consistent. Let's move on to theorem two. If something is godlike, the property of being godlike is an essence of that thing. Now this, the way Gödel has set it up, is actually the tricky proof. This is the one that takes a little bit of sophistication. Still, it's not that complicated a proof. It's not very hard to understand. Here's how it goes. Suppose that G, for example, is godlike. Then, by our first definition, G has as essential properties all and only positive properties. By axiom 3, the property of being godlike is positive. By axiom 6, so is the property of being necessarily godlike. Well, the property of being godlike is essential to this G, if and only if, for every property B, G has B necessarily, if and only if being godlike entails B. In other words, an essence is something that implies all and only those properties the thing has necessarily. So, being godlike is going to have to entail all and only the properties that godlike thing has necessarily. Well, we have to prove that. So we've got to show that for any B, G has B necessarily, if and only if being godlike implies B. Well, there's a left-to-right direction and a right-to-left direction for this, as any other if and only if biconditional sort of proof. So let's take a look first at the left-to-right direction. Say that G has B necessarily. Then B is positive. In fact, by axiom 4, it's necessarily positive. Anything godlike has B, so being godlike entails B. How about the right-to-left direction? Say that being godlike entails having property B. Then, by axioms 2 and 3, B is positive. B and G, being godlike, has B necessarily.
Now, theorem 3. Necessarily, the property of being godlike is exemplified. That's Gödel's way of saying God necessarily exists. So this is a very powerful result. Here's the proof. Suppose something is godlike, then it has every positive property. By axiom 5, it also has the property of necessarily existing. Now, we might think we're just done there. However, Gödel means something really strong by necessary existence, so let's continue. Any essence of X is necessarily exemplified. So the property of being godlike is an essence of X by theorem 2. So if anything is godlike, then necessarily the property of being godlike is exemplified. Necessarily something is godlike, having been proved using only necessary truths, that itself has to be a necessary truth. Well, by our first corollary, it's possible that something is godlike, so it's possible that necessarily something is godlike. So necessarily something is godlike. It can easily impress you that, wait, something very strange is going on in that last theorem. And in fact, there is something a little bit, well, controversial. Now, in a certain sense, not that controversial, but a bit controversial. So let me explain. There are really only two modal principles that are being used in this proof. One simply says that if A implies B, and A is possible, then B is possible. That one is pretty uncontroversial. That's true in all normal systems of modal logic. But the second one is much more controversial. It is the characteristic principle of a system known as S5. Now, S5 is the most popular system of modal logic for analyzing metaphysical necessity. It's something that was simply assumed by Aquinas, by Descartes, by Kant, really by everyone before the 20th century. In one form, that axiom says that if something is possible, then it's necessarily possible. Or, in the form it's used here, but it's an equivalent formulation, it is that if it's possible that something is necessary, then it is necessary. Now, clearly these things do not hold for every sense of necessity. After all, the first one, that if something is possible, it's necessarily possible, implies that being possible is not something that depends on contingent matters of fact. But yeah, our intuitive conception of possibility says, well, of course it is. It might be possible for me to bench press 300 pounds if I were younger and if I worked out much more than I do now. Well, okay, maybe it's possible for me under those circumstances, but it's not possible for me to do it now. And so we would think that the possibility of something like that depends on various contingent matters of fact. If we're thinking about metaphysical possibility, however, it's not obvious. In fact, it would seem that it's not true that that's the kind of thing that ought to depend on contingent matters of fact. And so for metaphysical possibility and necessity, it seems fairly plausible to say that if something's possible from a metaphysical point of view, that's a necessary truth. It's necessarily possible. And similarly, if it's possible for something to be necessary in this metaphysical sense, then it is necessary. It's metaphysically possible that this is necessary, so it is necessary. That is the modal principle that is assumed here. It is, in modal logic terms, something like an assumption of symmetry. That is to say, if one world is relevant to the evaluations of possibility and necessity from the point of view of another world, it goes the other direction as well. So let's say something is possible in our world in this metaphysical sense, That means, intuitively, it's true in some other metaphysically possible world, but then our world must also count as metaphysically possible from the point of view of that other world. That assumption is one that's required to make this argument work in the end. It's also required for us to understand various other, like the modal form of Anselm's original ontological argument, the proslogion 3 form. So S5, as I mentioned, is something that is controversial. It seems to me clearly wrong for certain senses of possibility and necessity. But it's really quite plausible for metaphysical possibility and necessity, and indeed it's the most popular logic used to analyze those terms. It was assumed by all of the major figures of medieval philosophy as well as early modern philosophy. Not until C.I. Lewis began developing a variety of systems of modal logic in the 20th century did people realize there are alternatives. Let me close with one quick mathematical note. The first three axioms could be summarized by saying that positive properties form an ultrafilter on the entailment ordering. And definition 1, as well as axiom 4, establish the godlike property as the principal element of that ultrafilter. Now, for those who don't know what an ultrafilter is, don't worry about it. But for those who do, I think that's actually a useful conception. But because what it suggests is that those axioms and definitions build in together the concept of God as in some form a maximal being. And that is the core idea behind ontological arguments. In Anselm, God is that the greater than which cannot be conceived. In Descartes, God is the being with all possible perfections. And here too, God is maximal. God is the principal element of an ultrafilter. And in logical terms, in mathematical terms, that is a conception of maximality. So we didn't directly say God is maximal, but we actually built it in through a combination of definitions and axioms. And that really is, I think, the core strategy of what Gödel was doing. In fact, his original axioms make that strategy even more obvious. So there is a notion of maximality, the maximal nature of God, that is at the core of this argument, as well as of the classic ontological arguments of Anselm and Descartes. And so we could say that the underlying strategy of all those arguments is to go from something mental to the actual existence of a thing. That's the very move that upset Aquinas, upset Kant, and a variety of others. But the idea is, if something is maximal, then it must exist. Maximality implies existence. In fact, necessary existence.